You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next hour, we find out what went wrong for Britain's coalition government and ask whether they can turn things around. We head to Athens to meet a Greek entrepreneur who'll give us his take on the messy aftermath of Sunday's election. And on the subject of elections, we'll cross over to Paris to discuss France's new First Lady. I'll also be joined here in the studio by historian Andrew Linklater, who'll be revealing all about the little-known story of Spencer Percival, the only British Prime Minister to be assassinated. All that, plus a chat with our culture editor, Rob Bound, a song or two, and our own musical tribute to the brilliant Maurice Sendak. All that's coming up on Midori House. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. A Russian Sukhoi passenger plane with 46 people on board has gone missing during a demonstration flight over West Java in Indonesia. Radio contact was lost with the plane after it descended to 6,000 feet. The Indonesian military said the plane literally fell from the sky. Stephen Trimble, an aviation expert from Flight Global, spoke to Monocle earlier about what happened.
Well, we know Sukhoi's spokeswoman, Olga Kayukova, has confirmed on her Facebook page, actually, that the aircraft has gone missing on its second demonstration flight from Jakarta today, this afternoon in Jakarta. It went missing about 20 minutes after takeoff. We know that it was flying in the whereabouts of a 7,000-foot-tall mountain, which may or may not be relevant to what actually happened.
The European Council President Herman Van Rompuy has arrived in Paris today to meet French President-elect François Hollande, whose anti-austerity election campaign swept him to the Élysée in Sunday's presidential ballot. The meeting comes ahead of an anticipated trip to Berlin, where top of the agenda will be Hollande's opposition to the austerity measures which have characterised the European reaction to the economic crisis. Hollande believes the austerity consensus is stifling growth. A group of United Nations ceasefire monitors have today visited Mastama and Ariha in the suburbs of the northern Syrian city of Idlib. The monitors talked to Syrian army members as well as to the civilian local residents. One local resident said Mastama was a ghost town. He said troops loyal to President Bashar al-Assad had raided the town, shooting and kidnapping the local people. A forest fire has broken out in a suburb of Los Angeles in the United States. The fire started at midnight GMT and spread over 51 hectares of forest. More than 350 firefighters and five helicopters were dispatched to battle the wildfire, according to the local fire department. Tony Imbrenda, the inspector of Los Angeles Fire Department, said the fire was under control.
We had one abandoned mobile home that was destroyed, one outbuilding. We had two vehicles and two cargo containers. So that is the total property that was damaged or destroyed by fire. Right now, it's undetermined when the evacuees can return to their homes. We're still making assessments on that.
In Athens, at the ruins of the Doric temple to goddess Hera, priestesses in pleated robes swayed under a scorching sun at the birthplace of the ancient Olympics today in the final rehearsal to light the flame that will burn at the London Games. The rehearsal ended with the high priestess handing the flame and a fresh olive branch to the first torchbearer, Spyros Giannotis, a Liverpool-born Greek swimmer who won the gold medal in the 10 kilometres open water event at last year's World Championships. He said this was a very special moment.
It's my last Olympics and I'm half English, so it's something unique for me, and I'm shaking now. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So I'm waiting for tomorrow. It's going to be very, very important for me and for my whole career.
And finally, according to a study in Denmark, children who wake in the night and sneak into their parents' bed are less likely to become overweight. Research looked into around 500 children aged between 2 and 6 and found those who stayed in their own beds were three times more likely to become overweight. Copenhagen University Hospitals, which carried out the study, said the difference could be linked to the psychological reaction to being either allowed or forbidden from entering their parents' bed. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
I've absolutely no idea what to make of that story at all, Jonathan. But thank you, as ever, very much. It is 5 past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The hair at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Essa é Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
This is Monocle 24.
Afto in the Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
There was pomp, and there was indeed circumstance. The Queen put on her best dress, a few jewels and a crown, took the carriage out of the garage, and popped down the road to Westminster to open Parliament. Amid all the pageantry, there was politics. It was an opportunity for David Cameron's coalition government to attempt a relaunch. 2 years after Cameron and his Liberal Democrat deputy Nick Clegg came to power, the government is in trouble. Its insistence on austerity has only led the UK back into recession, while a series of wholly avoidable stumbles have created an impression of incompetency that may be hard to shake. So how can Cameron and Clegg turn things around? We're joined on the line from Westminster by John Rentall, chief political commentator at The Independent on Sunday. John, welcome to Midori House. I'm assuming that Cameron and Clegg admitted today that they were wrong. They dipped into their old copies of Keynes and they came up with a plan B, no?
Yeah, almost. No, they didn't. They published a list of bills, most of which have got nothing to do with the economy or with their so-called agenda for growth. But the Prime Minister made a speech in which he said his mission was to rebuild Britain and clear up the mess that had been left by the other lot.
And is there, I mean, do you get the impression that he actually knows what he's doing, that he's accepting that, okay, he may not, you know, dip into old copies of Keynes, but he realises he needs to make a few changes here and there?
Well, no, because, I mean, I think they've got a real problem, and they can't really change the basic judgment that the coalition government made in 2010 when they formed, because to do so would be to admit that their entire economic strategy is wrong, and you know there's no way they can do that. So what they're forced to do is announce a number of trivial minor measures which make it easier to sack people or supposedly reduce red tape. But I mean, none of those. I mean, those might work in the good times. They might help if you believe in that kind of thing. But it doesn't affect the fact that there isn't enough demand in the economy, and so there's going to be a problem with jobs and growth, as long as other countries around us are also in financial difficulty.
But if, as you put it, their entire economic model is wrong or could be wrong, and you know, certainly when you look at other countries that have tried you know, similar things, it certainly hasn't worked anywhere else yet. You know, surely there must be a path they can take that you know may be politically difficult, but at least gets the economy going.
Well, yeah. That is sort of what they're trying to do, I think. They're trying to adjust the level of austerity that they're imposing in order to take into account the fact that the economy isn't growing without saying that that's what they're doing. But, I mean, it is very difficult. If you don't have growth, you can't do all the things that that the government promised they were going to do when the coalition was formed, which was to sort out the deficit and put the public finances on a sustainable footing. Now, if they don't have growth, they can't do that. And it's not as if the opposition has got any, you know, terrifically better ideas of what to do, because, you know, you could borrow more and stimulate the economy, but then confidence might go through the floor. I mean, it is an impossible position for any government.
Now, David Cameron's getting a lot of advice, none of it necessarily advice that he wants, but from all quarters, including from his own backbenchers, and certainly those that are perhaps a bit more right-wing than him. You had people saying that the reason that we lost all these seats last week is because we weren't right-wing enough. We were going on about gay marriage. Is there any truth in that at all? Did they lose because they talked about gay marriage?
None whatsoever. Gay marriage, wind turbines was the other thing that was blamed. I mean, this is the critique that's been made by the right wing of the Conservative Party since the last election,
And what I find extraordinary is that David Cameron feels he has to appease this viewpoint on his backbenches. And so, you know, he wrote a ridiculous article in the Daily Telegraph yesterday suggesting that he hated everything that the Labour government had done beforehand and that he shared all the ideas and instincts of his right wing. And, you know, that kind of thing. And then he gave an interview in the Daily Mail saying much the same thing and blaming the Liberal Democrats for holding him back. I mean, that kind of thing, I think, leads to a really confused message, because not clear whether the government has a sense of direction. If David Cameron's pretending that you know he's more right wing than he lets on, only the Liberal Democrats won't let him show his true colours.
Now you've been, you know, fairly supportive, could we say, of David Cameron at times in the past. You've said some nice things about him. You voted for Boris Johnson last week, although that's perhaps more to do with who he's up against.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's a danger that he is going to start losing people like you that consider themselves in the centre, where, you know, elections do tend to be won and lost?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, if he goes on saying everything about the previous Labour government was bad, then I think that puts off a lot of people in the centre ground of British politics who felt that the Labour government did a lot of good things but lost its way somewhat, especially under Gordon Brown. And I think, you know, that's not helped by the fact that Ed Miliband actually put in a very strong performance as leader of the opposition in his reply to the Queen's speech today. He actually, for once, stood up to David Cameron and gave a commanding performance in the House of Commons.
Talk us
to my surprise.
Well, yes, you've been critical of the Labour Party leader as well. Talk us through the sort of things that we need to look at over the next 2 or 3 years. There's likely to be an election in 2015 unless events happen and the coalition falls apart.
Yeah.
I mean, what are the key issues that could either lead to that coalition breaking up or that could put a real strain on it?
Well, I think the economy is obviously the number one issue, although it doesn't necessarily work in the simple way that one might suspect, because even if the economy becomes worse, there are arguments that suggest you'd want to stick with fiscal orthodoxy rather than take a risk on an untried Labour opposition. So, you know, the economy is a big factor, but it's not necessarily all one way. I mean, obviously, if we start to see a sharp recovery, then I think the government would be in a very strong position, and it'd be very difficult to see how the Conservatives could avoid winning a majority at the next election on their own strength of their own party, or unless David Cameron does more of this ridiculous posturing to his own right wing, suggesting things like referendums on Europe and that he doesn't really want to be in the European Court of Human Rights and all the rest of it. I mean, I think that's the one way he could throw it away, is just by policy incoherence and not deciding whether he's a right winger or a centrist.
I mean, is there an argument though that what you call right wing incoherence might actually be relatively sensible in the short term, in that it shores up his base, it reassures them that he's really on their side, maybe he throws them a bit of red meat, while at the same time, persuading that perhaps, gay marriage isn't really the end of the world. And the closer we get towards an election, turning more towards the centre.
Obviously, if you can pull that kind of trick off, all well and good. But you have to be a bit cleverer about it than I think David Cameron has been, just in the past few days. People do admire leadership. And I think if he just told his right wing that, a few facts of life, that the reason the Conservatives didn't win a majority at the last election was not because they weren't right-wing enough, then, I think he would gain a lot of respect from, centre-ground voters for that kind of truth-telling.
You mentioned that, the fact that, they didn't win a majority at the last election. A lot of people in the Conservative Party do seem to have some difficulty remembering that at times, don't they? That they didn't, that they did get 36% of the vote, and against an incredibly unpopular Prime Minister who was leading a party that had been in charge for 13 years, that just had a terrible recession that we weren't really still that far out of.
Yes, I think that's a real problem with the Conservative Party. First, they forget that they didn't win, and second, you know, once you challenge them on that, they go back to this position that the reason they didn't win was because they weren't right wing enough. I mean, this is hopeless. I mean, we saw in the elections last week the strength of the Labour brand. I mean, I'm no admirer of Ed Miliband, as you know, but you know the Labour Party remains very, very popular in the country, and people are prepared to vote for it. And if it had a decent leader, I think you know, it would carry all before it. But you know, even under Ed Miliband, I think the Labour Party is in quite a strong position because its values are more aligned with those of the electorate. And there are a lot of people in the Tory Party who just don't see that.
John Rentoul, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you, as ever. That was John Rentoul, Chief Political Commentator at The Independent on Sunday. And if you consider yourself a pedant, or there is a pedant in your life, do look for John's book, The Banned List, which does what it says on the tin, which actually is probably a phrase that's on the banned list. It's a list of banned words and phrases, which you should never really use. We're going to play a song now here on Midori House. This is Conquest by Sound of Arrows. And that was Sound of Arrows with Conquest. We're going to be back in a moment, sticking on a British political theme, but we're going to head back 200 years right after this.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
Pack your bags and join us on the latest episode of Section D as we head north to tackle Stockholm's ailing architecture landscape. We hit Tel Aviv to hear how it's saving its Bauhaus legacy, and we talk to the photographers of tomorrow at the IER Festival of Fashion and Photography.
I did a poster call on the streets in Bed-Stuy, a neighbourhood of Brooklyn in New York, to find someone who never took a photo. And I found a guy called Harrison, and he selected the photos for my photo ceiling installation.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now let me read to you a report from the Times of London from the 12th of May, 1812. From our report of the parliamentary proceedings of the two houses, will an indignant and sorrowful nation learn the occurrence of one of those horrible events with which the annals of Great Britain have not often been stained. The murder of Mr. Percival, the Prime Minister of these realms, a man who, in his personal intercourse, gave offence to none, in his private life was an example to all, and who, however firm and unbending in his principles, yet conducted political conflicts in a way that seemed to disarm them of their characteristic bitterness. The assassination of Spencer Percival, exactly 200 years ago this week, is actually remembered by few in Britain today. Historian Andrew Linklater hopes to correct that. He's the author of a new book, Why Spencer Percival Had to Die, and he joins us here in Studio One right now. Andrew, welcome.
Hello, good evening.
Let's start, first of all, with the story, the assassination itself, how it happened.
Well, 5 p.m, 11th of May, Monday, 1812, a large, tall, 5 foot 10 inches, for that era, pretty tall, stranger was sitting on a bench in the lobby, wearing brown coat. He's very fashionably dressed.
Curiously, this is the lobby in the House of Commons.
Lobby of the House of Commons. Curiously, if you read Le Beau Monde, which was absolutely the Bible for fashionable young men of the time, they specified almost exactly the clothes he was wearing. Dark overcoat, rather snazzy yellow and black waistcoat, clay-coloured breeches, and very nice Hessian boots, untanned leather. So there he was sitting. Everyone noticed afterwards that he had been breathing very heavily, the sweat pouring off him. His breast was panting. And just after 5 o'clock, the door of the lobby opened And in came Spencer Percival, Right Honourable Spencer Percival, Chancellor of the Exchequer and Prime Minister. Diminutive figure, only about 5'4", quite sort of soberly dressed, a dark blue overcoat, dark trousers. Hardly anyone noticed him, and so hardly anyone actually saw what happened, except for the gatekeeper, and he saw the gentleman in the dark chocolate brown coat rise to his feet, towering over Spencer Percival, held a large 9-inch pistol pretty well to his chest, and fired a big bullet, half an inch across, and it smashed into Percival's chest, pulverized his heart, his lungs, killed him pretty well instantly. He staggered a few feet across the lobby, fell to the ground, and was probably dead at the time he fell, but two members of Parliament picked him up and pulled him into the nearby room, and he was pronounced dead when a surgeon arrived a few minutes later, leaving outside total pandemonium.
And talk us through why this would happen. I mean, what were the, you know, what were the political issues at the time that had, you know, had caused such turmoil?
Well, Spencer Percival, perhaps I should just sort of draw back a little. I mean, he's a sort of pub quiz prime minister, really sort of totally unknown today. And it is rather extraordinary because at the time he dominated politics. He was leader of, if you like, the most powerful democracy in the world, engaged in an ideological war to the death with France, with revolutionary France under Napoleon. And he had established a real sort of terrific political dominance, really because he was conducting the war so well, so effectively. He was finding the money to build up an alliance against Napoleon, to finance Wellington's army in Spain. He had really sort of a terrific dominance in the House of Commons, where most of the MPs supported him. The other interesting thing about his position, he'd been appointed by King George III just before George III went mad. Now, normally, a prime minister was answerable to the king at the time. This is before the House of Commons was reformed, so there's really very little democratic control, but what control there is comes from the king. And then George III went mad. And so effectively, Spencer Percival had this huge amount of power. He had become prime minister in 1809, and by 1812, he was really pretty well unchallengeable.
So why would anyone want to kill him? I mean, what were the reasons behind his assassination?
The reasons really depend on where you start from. The conventional history, the conventional take of history, which is really why you don't hear about Spencer Percival or about his assassin, John Bellingham, is that John Bellingham was a madman who came in, who had a personal grudge against the Prime Minister and shot him out of a sense of a personal grudge.
But you disagree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think if you look at it, it is extraordinary that idea ever really took hold. Indeed, at the moment the shot was fired and people heard about it, everyone said, is that a conspiracy or just a lone gunman? And the immediate presumption was it would be a conspiracy because he was an incredibly divisive prime minister. He'd done very well as a war leader, but he had passed sort of terrible laws. I don't know if you heard of the Luddites, who really kept breaking machinery at the very beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And Spencer Percival made it a capital offence, you know, punishable by death to break a machine. He passed laws against the Irish, against the Catholics, against liberal reformers. And he saw himself, absolutely, he was an agent of providence. Everything was black and white. You know, what he did was right. Anyone who opposed him wasn't just wrong, but an evil agent.
What fascinates me most about this book and about this story is how little of it is actually known. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just Americans who can tell you all about, you know, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. This is, you know, famous all over the world, and yet with Spencer Percival, not only is he you know, pretty much unknown outside these shores, but in the UK itself. You know, we did a quick straw poll in the office earlier, and very few people have been taught about the life and times of Spencer Percival when they were at school. Why is that? Why don't we really know much about him?
Well, he belonged to this sort of dark era before the House of Commons reformed, when it was really pretty undemocratic. You had these rotten boroughs where you just have two or three electors, and they would elect a member of Parliament. And when the Victorians came along later in the 19th century, and we think of the Victorians pretty fuddy-duddy, well, the Victorians thought of politics before the Reform Act of 1832 as the Dark Ages. And there was this man, Spencer Percival, who, I mean, he did really weird things. He was quite like Reagan in a way. You remember when Reagan went to negotiate with Gorbachev at Reykjavik to end the Cold War, he didn't just go on any random date. He consulted his astrologer, Isabel Quigley, in San Francisco before deciding that it was a good date to go. And the same was true of Spencer Percival. He looked at the Bible. He read the Book of Revelations and the Book of Daniel for prophecies. And he took his decisions on what he found in the Book of Revelations, which led him, I mean, Reagan called the communists the evil empire. Well, he called Napoleon the mother of harlots, which is going a bit further than Reagan.
It is, but slightly.
But he saw it in exactly those terms.
Tell me, when you were researching this book, I mean, did you know already that there was definitely something more to the story than, oh, it was just a madman? Or was it, you know, did you just think, well, let's just see what I find?
No, I was just interested in reading, in finding out more about it. But I had no ideas, preconceptions about it. But the thing that really, you know, alerted me to it was the fact that Bellingham himself said he was totally destitute. He got letters from his wife after he left Liverpool to come to London, beginning of January 1812. And she said, come home, we've no money at all. And then you looked at his accounts books and you looked at his expenditure, and he was spending money hand over fist for those 4.5 months between the beginning of January and the 11th of May. So you ask yourself, where did the money come from?
Andrew Linklater, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. The book is Why Spencer Percival Had to Die. Thank you very much for joining us. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be discussing the new First Lady in France, and we'll be joined in the studio by Rob Bound to talk culture. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines.
Thanks very much. A Russian Sukhoi passenger plane with 46 people on board has gone missing during a demonstration flight over West Java in Indonesia. Radio contact was lost with the plane after it descended to 6,000 feet. The Indonesian military said the plane literally fell from the sky. The European Council President Herman Van Rompuy has arrived in Paris today to meet the French President-elect François Hollande, whose anti-austerity election campaign swept into the Elysee in Sunday's presidential ballot. A group of United Nations ceasefire monitors have today visited Mastama and Ariha in the suburbs of the northern Syrian city of Idlib. The monitors talked to Syrian army members as well as to civilian local residents. A forest fire has broken out in a suburb of Los Angeles in the USA. The fire started at midnight GMT and spread over 51 hectares of forest. More than 350 firefighters and 5 helicopters were dispatched to battle the wildfire, according to the local fire department. And for the moment, those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
No mundo todo, essa é a Monocle 24.
Haul la alam, Hana Monocle, Arba Washrin.
En todo el mundo, esta es Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, Estokio. Es a Monocle 24.
Από όλο τον κόσμο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Warte rund, det här är Monocle 24.
Überall auf der Welt, das ist Monocle 24.
Det coolaste Monocle 24.
Around the world, this is Monocle 24.
The fallout from Sunday's election in Greece is still reverberating around Europe. Alexis Tsipras, the leader of Greece's leftist coalition, is unlikely to be able to form a majority government, leaving the country facing the queasy possibility of a swift return to polling stations next month. Meanwhile, the rise of the neo-Nazi Golden Dawn Party has seriously damaged the country's international image. Some Greeks, though, are still hopeful. And one of those is Yason Sakonas, an Athens-based entrepreneur who founded the property development company Olearos in 2002. Yason, thank you very much for joining us. Why so optimistic?
Good evening, first of all, from Greece. So optimistic. I would say I'm concerned and optimistic. Optimistic from the point of view that we are in the process of a big change that has been long due. And I think it's natural to have all kinds of, I would even say, violent attributes to it, where this is where I would put the Nazi Party. Because there is a big frustration within the society that we need to change the structure and we are looking for ways to go forward. And in that sense, being in the generation that is active and should be more active in the years to come, I think that there is hope that things may be changing, and I hope they will be changing fast.
You say you're concerned and optimistic. Is it fair to say you're concerned for the short term, but optimistic for the medium to long term?
This is one way to look at it. I'm concerned because I want to make sure that there are enough people that are thinking the way I am, and I think they are, but they will find a way to act wisely over the months to come, because we are walking on quite a risky territory. So the concern is that, as you mentioned, there is a Nazi party that has come out. My interpretation for the Nazi party is that this does not really have much political, standing. I think it's more a result of the absence of the state and of implementing the laws. I mean, I can see it in the center of Athens where I live and work, where, drug dealing and prostitution and free trade of anything is on, and the police is not really in the position to act. And this is where the Nazi Party started, because they offer physical protection to the old people that they are being robbed, in the ghetto neighborhood. That's how they started. So this is a social phenomenon, not a necessarily political phenomenon.
When you consider the current volatility, what does it actually mean in reality for you and your business? How does it affect how you operate?
I think, if you look at it on a micro level or daily level, it definitely, the economy has been in a standstill for quite a while. The banking system does not really function. And when somebody like the left, like the Tsipras party, announced, yesterday morning that the way they will deal with the economy is to guarantee and use the deposits in the banks, which are 165 billion, of course, you have people who are rushing to the banks. This affects everybody in the economy on a daily basis. It makes, specifically with me, I have clients that I have sold vacation houses on the island of Antiparos, high-end houses, that they're looking at the statistics that there's a chance we'll get out of Europe. And they're holding back, for example, to commencing the construction of a house. So on an immediate, or I have agreed to sell a house to a New York art dealer. She has given a deposit. She's listening to the news and all the chaos that supposedly is coming out. She's thinking twice about it. Although in reality, in both cases, they're summer houses, they're high-end. It's been one of the most safe and calm islands. In reality, there's no risk to that, in that sense, because it's an international destination and the value, I think, will always be internationally, calculated. It will be compared to other destinations in the Mediterranean. But psychologically, it does affect my business, obviously.
Yason, how long can this sort of uncertainty go on for you before you think it affects your business too much, before you start thinking, actually, should I be heading somewhere else? Should I be moving into a different industry?
How long? That's a good question. I would say I'm a property developer. I would say I'm a bespoke property developer, dealing a lot with contemporary architecture and trying to bring in a new model for property development in Greece. So I'm kind of a startup developer in a way. So I'm dealing by definition even in more specified markets. Like I said earlier, one is the island of Antipolos, and then I have quite a big project I'm trying to push through in the city center in Athens. And I am looking into a new project to develop in Switzerland, where I have been invited to participate as a co-developer. But I'm also looking to develop a new project in one of the most beautiful islands in Greece, in a very virgin piece of land, again targeting high-end individuals. I think the best asset we have will always be the islands. And my approach to the islands is that we need to take care of them, design them properly, go probably for a higher-end market and more low density, bring in contemporary architecture, Greek and international architects. I think as a product, this is something that is addressing the next step forward, the next generation. And I do feel comfortable at this point. I know that it may take some time. I need to have patience. It's a matter of structuring up myself. On the other hand, because of all this crisis, in the Athens project, after like 6 years of trying to get people's act together, the government, the municipality, etc., because now everybody's alert and they are trying to do things, so finally I'm reaching a point where the whole project in the center of Athens may be dealt with in a coordinated manner.
Yes, on this seems to be, whatever happens next in Greece seems to be pretty dependent, not just on people like yourself and entrepreneurs, but also having a political class that not only understands the problems, but shows some sort of leadership and is able to find some way through. Do you think, and you certainly don't have to tell us which way you voted, but I mean, do you think that Greece has those political leaders, or do you think it's quite vital that a new generation come through pretty quickly?
I think it's very extremely vital for a new generation to come up quickly. And the answer is, you see, this guy, Alexis Tsipras, who's like 36 years old, and essentially he's the only one who represents my generation. And this can be seen also by the people who have voted for him. And they have not really voted for what he was professing. I think that they were voting more out of desperation and a way the people want to have the two major parties, which is the previous generation, the generation of the server, after the junta. They want this whole political structure, including several parts, the media people, the business people, that generation, a big part of that generation, people think that have caused the big problem. So they are looking for the next generation to come up.
On Sakonas, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're right back after this. Maurice Sendak, author of Where the Wild Things Are, died yesterday at the age of 83. For decades, he refused to allow anyone to make a film version of his most famous work, finally relenting when Spike Jonze and Dave Eggers came calling. Jonze's soundtrack while working on the script was Arcade Fire's first album, Funeral, and this track, Wake Up, was used on the beautiful trailer. Love that. That was Arcade Fire with Wake Up. We'll be right back after this.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and again how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time. From 8 a.m. London time and 9 a.m. Central European time every weekday, Monocle 24 presents The Continental Shift. Our editors guide you through 4 hours of hand-picked music, from Danish ballads to German electro-pop and beyond. That's The Continental Shift, right here on Monocle 24.
you're back with Midori House. Now, as François Hollande, France's newly elected president, takes centre stage at the Elysee Palace, his partner, Valérie Thiers-Vallière, is also awaiting her turn as First Lady. But who is Madame Thiers-Vallière? She is neither a former supermodel or a household name, as was Carla Bruni, wife of the outgoing president Nicolas Sarkozy. Rather, she is a journalist whose career spans over two decades. And interestingly, she's going to be the very first lady to be an unwed companion to a French president. We're joined now by Tom Burgess-Watson, our correspondent in Paris, who hopefully will be able to give us some insight into the role of the French First Lady. Tom, welcome to Midori House. Welcome back, rather, to Midori House. What can you tell us about Madame Thiers-Vallière?
Well, she's not had a hugely high profile until quite recently. She's been a journalist at Paris Match for the last 20 years, and it was in that job that she actually met her president slash boyfriend to be, and they got together about 5 or 6 years ago. At least that's when their relationship became public. And she says she doesn't want the limelight. She doesn't want to get married to François Hollande just for the sake of it. She's playing very much the same sort of dancing to the same tune as her partner. I'm talking about being Mr. and Mrs. Ordinary, and Mr. Normal was a very big catchphrase during François Hollande's campaign. He said, "I'm a very normal person." In fact, many people in France think that it's extremely normal that their relationship should be as it is, and that they shouldn't be married, and that just reflects modern French life. So one could say that they're an extremely modern couple that reflect modern France.
And what is the role of the First Lady in France? I mean, is it an official role in the same way it is in the US, or is it more of an unofficial thing that's sort of been created into something a bit bigger through the media in recent years?
It's varied very much from lady to lady, in fact. I think the person who summed up the answer to your question the best is the late Danielle Mitterrand, who was the wife of François Mitterrand, who she died last year, in fact. She said there is no traditional role for a first lady in France, and she said that each woman has her own personality and does what she what her conscience tells her to do, and in particular Danielle Mitterrand, she had a number of causes that were extremely close to her heart. She was a really feisty individual. She'd been in the French Resistance from the age of 19, and she was awarded the Croix de Guerre, which is a very prestigious military honor for her bravery. That was long before she met her husband-to-be, the socialist president François Mitterrand. And she had causes like the cause of the Kurds, the Tibetans. She was famous for kissing Fidel Castro. She really took a lot of causes under her wing, as did Madame Pompidou, who was another formidable first lady. Claude Pompidou was, she was a major philanthropist, championing the rights of the disabled, the elderly, and she was, again, a very different character. That was back in the 70s. And then, of course, you had Carla Bruni, who was not the first French lady of Nicolas Sarkozy. She was actually wife number two during his time as president.
He ran for office with wife number one by his side.
Exactly. So he had one wife running for office and another wife from about May of... No, I think it was in February 2008 that Carla appeared on the scene. And so he entered the Elysee Palace with one wife and left with another. So I think the answer is, and then the interesting thing about Carla, of course, is she was busy on the one hand at his side during official functions and on the international circuit, but she was also producing an album while she was in the Elysee Palace. It didn't sell a huge number of copies, I don't think.
No, well, having listened to it, I don't think it really deserved to.
It was original, and that in itself gave it a bit of cachet.
That is true. Just finally, is there any indication yet of what sort of role Valérie Thiers-Vallière is actually going to play?
No, it's not clear, and I think people are on a bit of a sort of the pundits are in a bit of a spin here, wondering, first of all, what are we going to call this dear lady? I mean, is she going to be called the first girlfriend, one newspaper was saying this morning? And then, of course, the whole question of what happens if and when, which in fact it's a question of when, not if, François Hollande goes to Britain and meets the Queen, because the Queen doesn't receive girlfriends. So this is the the first unmarried premier dame to go into the Elysee Palace, and that leaves a lot of questions, not just about what to call her, but as you say, what her role should be. But she's an independent woman. She's she's intelligent. She's worked, as I said, for 20 years as a journalist, and she's got a background in politics and law. She's got children of her own. He has children by Ségolène Royal, who again, it's wondered what role she's going to have. It's a very interesting dynamic to the relationship that his predecessor in the job is his head of the Socialist Party is actually his ex-consort. Again, they weren't married. They didn't really believe in marriage. A lot of people on the French left say that marriage is for the bourgeoisie, and it's something that they don't want to enter into as an institution. But I think being normal is the absolute watchword for François Hollande, and that's going to be what Valérie Trivelliard wants to do as well. She doesn't want to be the flashy millionaire supermodel that was Carla Bruni. She wants to be someone very different, and I think it's fair to say she's going to make a very original stamp on that role, which indeed is a new role. It isn't. It is uncharted territory.
Tom, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Tom Burgess Watson in Paris. Thank you very much indeed. We're going to be back in a moment with a little bit of culture.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, yeah, you're welcome.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. I've been joined here in the cosy confines of Studio One with Robert Bound.
Could be cosy, it could be Studio Two.
It could be, yes. Studio Two is considerably cozier.
So cozy, you can hear your stomach rumbling.
Really?
All the way from here to Tokyo.
I don't know what you're talking about.
That's true.
That's Tom Burgess Watson. You're here to talk about culture, aren't you?
I am.
Specifically about what's been on the what's going to be coming up.
Well, it's a bit of a sell, this, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
Steve,
no, that's quite right.
We just cut next week's culture show because I'm going to be away, and we did it about the art of wandering. And on that show about the art of wandering, why wandering is allied to the art of looking as well. Why
yes.
You should take time to look around you and see the sort of the exotic in the ordinary and this sort of thing. On that show, we had a man that we're both fans of, Ian Sinclair.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, novelist, writer, sort of London historian, psychogeographer. And he was once described as a demented magus of the sentence. A brilliant thing to be described as.
I was going to make some comment about his long sentences and his sort of vocab, but I couldn't have come up with a better phrase than that.
It's a good one, isn't it?
It really is.
Who did that? I can't remember who wrote that. And also, Patrick Keeler, you might know, we didn't have him on. We had the curator of his show at the Tate. He's a filmmaker. He's a man who, again, is obsessed with geography, landscape, sort of plowing down into places to kind of find their DNA in history. And he's a kind of filmmaker. And he's also put a show on at the Tate. So we had the curator on for that. So that is what next week's show is going to be about. And I thought I could tell you a little bit about Patrick Keeler, possibly, and his show.
Why don't you?
His show.
Before we do that, can I just ask, what was Ian Sinclair like? Was he good?
He's very good. I was lucky enough for another show on this network, to go and have a walk around Hackney with him.
Oh, yeah, you did, yes.
Just before Christmas, I think. So it was cool.
So you're old friends now?
We're old mates, yeah. It was like, Ian, Rob, how's it going? Great to see you. You wouldn't mind popping in, would you? So it's cool. He's wonderful. And he does talk, as we said, he's been described as a demented maker of sentences. He talks like he writes, which is a pretty rare feat. He does talk in whole
Brilliant.
Sentences. You sort of want to always... Well, luckily, we did record it all. But, you know.
I was going to say,
you felt like if you were down the pub with him, you'd kind of want to have a dictaphone subtly in your pocket so you could sort of write down his best bits.
Good. So we've got that to the forte. But tell us more about Patrick Keeler then.
So Patrick Keeler is a filmmaker. He's a similar guy. He shares similar sort of preoccupations and obsessions, really, as Ian Sinclair. A lot of his obsessions are sort of go back right back to the Enclosure Act in the 18th century, and sort of how public space, or how what was once public space, common ground, in England and across the UK has become now sort of privatised, and there's big gates up to stop you wandering. So on the theme of wandering, we wonder whether we discuss with Ian and with the curator, Catherine Stout of the Tate, whether or not, we've become anti-wandering, whether or not it was impossible to do this.
And do you think we have?
I think so. I think it seems that, or that's what Patrick Keeler seems to be saying through the medium of Robinson. Now, I've got to tell you about Robinson. The show, at the Tate is called the Robinson Institute. Robinson is this sort of fictional itinerant scholar that Patrick Keeler has invented in order to sort of be his slightly unreliable narrator in his films, essentially. So you get a feeling that most of these ideas are Patrick Keeler's ideas, but Patrick Keeler sort of takes on the I. If it were Withnail and I, Robinson is the Withnail and Patrick Keeler is sort of the I.
Excellent.
If you know what I mean. So it's very much that's sort of how it goes. And it kind of traces these films, but traces, as I say, it tries to find out where everything that we consume sort of comes from. It's a bit of a critique of capitalism.
Yeah.
I called it crapitalism.
Crapitalism. Nice one.
By accident.
It sounds like the real anarchist inside you has burst into coming out.
You can have that at the Daily Mirror.
I do wonder about wondering whether a lot of the reason why we don't wander so much anymore is also because we're distracted by other things. We've got, you know, the phone in the pocket, the number of people you bump into on the tube who are walking and reading their Kindle at the same time. Is that fair? Do you think there's another reason why we're...
There are all these modes of transport. I like to walk around London as much as possible. I don't like to, I don't like to go on the tubes, I like to have a bus or walk around. But Ian Sinclair, interesting, said something today about cycling. He said even cycling has become a sort of politicised activity. You ride a Boris bike and you advertise Barclays when you're, and it's supposedly opening up new parts of the city, which it isn't at all. All they're really doing is blocking off places you can walk, especially with his great bugbear, which is the Olympic project.
Some would call them crapitalists, wouldn't they? now, should we play? We're coming up to the top of the hour, so we haven't got long enough for an entire song. But
okay.
Should we play a little snippet of a song?
Yeah,
I
didn't want anyone to go away empty-handed on this show.
No. Everyone's a winner on Midori House.
Indeed, I wanted to play you a track from Richard Hawley's new record. It comes out. It's reviewed in the Monocle that will be hitting your shelves next week. It's from the album called Standing at the Sky's Edge, and this slowie is called Seek It.
That was very, very lovely indeed.
He's very mellifluous. That record is full of northern English psycho kind of stuff, but that's cool.
Standing at the Sky's Edge is the album, Richard Hawley, the artiste. Thank you very much, Rob. Thank you very much, all of you. Indeed, that was the end of Midori House. The show is produced by Chanel Townsend, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Sam Impey. The news is next. Then it's The Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw. But that was Midori House. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.